MechCast, Wednesday, March 9th, 2016. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, it's interesting when we're between products like this. We're in this phase where we're getting ready for Apple to come out with a couple of announcements, hopefully later this month. So you'd think, you know, some of the rumors and things are going to be heating up. But beyond that, we may or may not have much to talk about. And I'm just perusing through the show notes today, and boy, do we have a lot of stuff to talk about. Have to talk about a bunch of iPhone stuff, of course, new displays. We also have updates on what's going to happen in March, what's coming next with the iPhone 7, a little bit of info about Apple's efforts in China and India. We're going to talk about that a little bit. This thing with the NFL. We have just a tad, tiny, little itty-bitty thing to talk about, somewhat related to the San Bernardino iPhone FBI thing, but we're moving pretty much past that. We also have a little bit of feedback from you on that topic, because I asked you to chime in. So we got some good comments in the emails. So we're going to cover those. Also, Oculus, they're bad-mouthing the Mac a little bit, and we're going to talk about that and see if it's a little bit justified. And we have a little malware to talk about, actually something kind of serious. And we're going to get into that, and I'm also going to give you a tip related to that a little bit later in the show. And then we have some questions from you. Some information about USB installers, some HomeKit frustration, and autocorrect issues on the iPhone. So we're going to talk about all of that. But before we get into it, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Gazelle. Hey, listen, I'm going to guess that many of you have an old iOS device lying around that you're not using. Yeah, you upgraded. Maybe you got a new one. It's just sitting over there in the corner. You haven't handed it down. You don't plan on doing anything with it. Why not take that old device and get some cash for it? Gazelle makes this process super easy to do. And one of the reasons it might be sitting there is you're like, I don't want to deal with the hassle of having to find a buyer and dealing with... Hey, Gazelle is your buyer. It's easy and free to get a quick online offer. And you might be thinking, oh, maybe it's not worth anything. Give it a shot. You have really nothing to lose. Gazelle is going to give you an offer on your device. All you have to do is just answer a few simple questions. You get an instant price quote. It's good for 30 days. They're going to honor it. And you don't even have to worry if your device is broken, because that's another excuse I'll hear people say, oh, it's got a broken screen. No one wants that. Gazelle will buy broken devices as well. You might be surprised. So it's worth just going to the website, gazelle.com, checking it out. And if the offer there is something you like, you want to take advantage of, they make it really easy to send in. Shipping is free, and in many cases, they'll give you a box to send it in. They give you the label. The process could not be simpler. And once they receive your device, they're going to check it over. They're going to remove any personal information, any data. And then as long as it matches the condition that you said it was in, you get a fast and quick payment. You can get paid by check in the mail. You can get paid by direct deposit into your PayPal account, or you can choose the option for an Amazon gift card. And if you do that, you're going to get even a better price on your offer. You get a little bit extra. And Gazelle has great customer service. They've helped over 1 million people sell devices, and they've paid out over $200 million to their customers. So what are you waiting for? You can get cash for your old iPhone today. All you have to do is go to gazelle.com. And a big thank you to them for their continued support of the MacCast. Here we go again. OLED displays on the iPhone. We've been hearing this rumor for a while. Guess what? As a lot of our rumors do, they circle back around. They come back. Whether we want to talk about it or not, the rumors now are saying that Apple has been discussing ramping up OLED production, display production, with a couple of their major suppliers, LG and Samsung. They've also reportedly been telling the appropriate industry associations to prepare for a switch sometime in the near future. Now, the rumors are saying that one of the key drivers for Apple wanting to move to OLED is so that they can create some different designs. We've kind of had the same iPhone designs for a while now, so they want to be able to have a little bit more flexibility, maybe do a little more things with stuff like curved edges and curved screens, or maybe even screens that wrap around the edges of the device. And in order to do that, OLED is going to make that possible. OLED allows for thinner displays, so they can also thin things down, which Apple tends to like to do, and you get higher contrast ratios with much deeper blacks. If you look at the Apple Watch, you cannot really tell when the screen is off, where, or even when it's on, where that seam is between the bezel kind of around the edge of the display and the display itself. It kind of makes this seamless transition, and Apple really likes that style and look. Actually, I like that style and look. I think it really looks nice. It looks like the display goes edge to edge. And so if Apple wants to achieve that, they need to make that switch to that OLED technology. They do pretty good with their existing displays right now, but it's going to take it to the next level. And you get power and efficiency benefits, and there's a lot of benefits into making the move. But in the past, it's been hard for display suppliers to provide the volume of OLED displays that Apple would need, or that at least that's what we've been hearing. So I know we've had previous reports that claimed that Apple was looking to move to OLED iPhone displays in 2018. As a matter of fact, analyst Ming-Chi Kuo has stated he believes Apple won't make the move until 2019. So this sort of pushing it up to 2017 is a little bit interesting. And production volume really could wind up being an issue with the sped up timeline. It's going to be, can LG and Samsung actually come forward and make this happen? Sharp, which is another display supplier, has also been reportedly trying to increase production volume as well, potentially to meet orders for Apple. Now, one possibility, if they can't get things ramped up in time, is that Apple could limit the OLED display to higher end iPhone models, maybe just the Plus models or something like that. And as a matter of fact, DigiTimes reported that the new OLED display would be exclusive to a all new larger 5.8 version of the iPhone, maybe starting with the iPhone 7S or the iPhone 8 series. Now, I'm not sure I really buy into Apple increasing the display size beyond the current 5.5 one on the S. I don't see them introducing a whole nother display size. And, you know, DigiTimes has been hit or miss on rumors in the past. So I don't know. What do you think? Is that what we're going to get? We're going to get a mega iPhone. I'm not looking, you know, I already think the S, as you know, is too large. This last round moved it down to the iPhone 6S instead of the 6S Plus for that exact reason. I think it's too big. I know a lot of people like that form factor, but I just don't see Apple going any bigger than that. But the moving up of the timeline could also be a way for Apple to try and counter this issue we've been talking about, where iPhone sales are kind of seeing this slow leveling off. I don't think we're going to hit the decline anytime soon. I think Apple's going to continue to sell, but they're not selling year over year unit numbers that are showing a massive growth like they have been having. And so one way to do that would be to bring out a radical new design, maybe a display, like I was saying earlier, that wraps around the edge, switch to a new display technology, and that's going to entice more people to upgrade. So could be looking at the date shifting from 2018, 2019 to maybe 2017, 2018 to kind of help counteract some of that effect. Also, we've been hearing some additional rumors around the iPhone 7 that Apple may switch the LTE chips in them, moving to a chip that's being built by Intel. There's been multiple reports that have surfaced that say a significant portion, probably 30 to 40% of the LTE chips in the next generation iPhone could be produced by Intel. Apple's typically used Qualcomm chips. The rest are still expected to be supplied by Qualcomm, And Apple does tend to like to have multiple suppliers. They don't like to have to rely always on one supplier for all of an individual component. Now, as far as which Intel chip they're going to use, it's an LTE modem chip called the 7360, and it would have a faster theoretical downlink speed of up to 450 megabits per second with upload speeds of 100 megabits per second, and would add support for the 10 and 29 LTE bands. So adding some additional functionality, speed, sounds like a pretty nice modem chip. And again, it's good for Apple to not always rely on a single supplier. Now, another option for future phones could be Apple integrating the LTE modem actually right into the A series processor. And that might be another reason why Apple's in talks with Intel, because they could potentially license the modem technology, the intellectual property from either company, really, Intel or Qualcomm, and then integrate that right into Apple's own chip designs. But they're going to have to do some licensing deals to make that happen. So again, it's going to be nice to have a couple different suppliers that maybe they can play off of when they're trying to get that deal done. But sounding like there may be a couple different modem chips in the iPhone 7, depending upon which one you end up getting. And then we're also seeing the rumored case designs for the iPhone 7 starting to surface. And so far, they seem to be pretty consistent with a lot of the rumors we've been hearing, including that rumor that Apple may be replacing the 3.5 millimeter headphone jack with just using the Lightning connector. And we're also seeing the left and right speaker cutouts seeming to confirm that, yeah, they're going to move to a stereo speaker system in the iPhone 7. Now, along with the iPhone 7 case leaks, we're also seeing case leaks for the rumored 4-inch iPhone, which is now being called the iPhone SE. And they seem to show a design that looks very similar to the iPhone 5S, including the sleep-wake button still being placed along the top of the phone. There had been some rumors that Apple might be moving it to the side, like in the iPhone 6 series or 6S series. But it's still on the top in these case designs that are being leaked. And also, it does have the headphone jack along the bottom. That was pretty much to be expected. It's sounding like Apple's not going to replace the headphones until the iPhone 7 model comes out, probably sometime in the fall. But that's kind of the latest on the iPhone. Now, one other little thing somewhat related to iPhone rumors is that Apple has rolled out the 6th version of its beta software, both for iOS and OS X, along with watchOS. They sent it out to developers and public beta testers, and this is just a week after they issued beta 5. So Apple is ramping up the beta releases. That tends to indicate that we should get some official releases probably pretty soon. So you've got iOS 9.3, OS 10.11.4, and watchOS 2.2, all moving to beta 6. Now, interestingly, Apple had been keeping up with tvOS on the betas. We got a tvOS beta 5, but it doesn't look like we got a tvOS beta 6. So I don't think there's anything to read into there, just that there's probably not as many things to tweak as Apple's moving toward whatever the launch date would be. And I would expect that we're probably going to get the new updates along with the March announcement again, which is expected to, I think, happen the week of the 20th. So it's looking like the 21st might be when Apple does their little special event where we expect them to announce the iPhone SE, also the iPad Pro, I think is what we talked about last time. This was what was going to be the iPad Air 3. Some believe now that might just be simply the 9.7-inch version of an iPad Pro, so you'd have two iPad Pro sizes, and then some watch band updates and some style combinations and things like that are expected to be announced. But we'll have to stay tuned. Hopefully Apple will be sending out invites for that in the coming weeks. Quick little update on Apple Pay in China. It's looking to be a resounding success. China Merchants Bank claimed this week that 3 million cards were activated with Apple Pay in the first 2 days of availability. Now, on average, Apple Pay users in China spent just over $15 each during the launch period. So 3 million times $15 each. Yeah, you can do the math on that. It's from some pretty good numbers, and it's only going to grow from there. almost 20 banks representing about 80% of UnionPay cards in China are now supporting Apple Pay. So it's opened up to a huge portion of that population, and it's sounding like they're enjoying it. And I think, why not? I love Apple Pay. I'm trying to use it more and more. And if you haven't had a chance to check it out yet, I made my thing of the moment, a cool little app called Payfinders that helps you find Apple Pay locations near you. So if you're in a place that has Apple Pay support right now, Payfinders, I think, is exclusive to the U.S., but hopefully they're going to be rolling it out to other countries soon. And I think it's a handy little app to check out. But Apple Pay in China, certainly doing very well. Looks like we're not going to get Thursday night NFL on our Apple TVs, at least not through a deal between Apple and the NFL. Apple has reportedly decided to not bid on the broadcast rights for some Thursday night NFL games for Apple TV. Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Verizon, and Yahoo had all reportedly been invited to bid on the streaming rights. Yahoo took advantage of it actually last year, and the bid would have been reportedly for 18 regular season games for this upcoming season. It's looking like Apple just felt the benefits did not end up being worth the cost. Yahoo, for example, last season paid $15 to $20 million to stream a single game, and NBC and CBS reportedly are going to pay $225 million, about $45 million per game, to televise and stream five games each in the 2016-2017 season. So that's kind of the prices we're looking at, and I guess Apple just didn't think it'd be enough draw to sell more Apple TVs just for the NFL stuff. Now, the bidding with the remaining companies is expected to finish up by March 20th. So we'll find out who actually goes in on this deal. And Apple pulling out doesn't necessarily mean you won't be able to stream Thursday night NFL on your Apple TV, because a lot of the other bidders have apps that are available for Apple TV. So you might just be watching it from within an app rather than through, you know, some other mechanism on the Apple TV itself. And so we're going to wait and see if we're going to get NFL Thursday Night Football on Apple TV, but you'll probably be able to go to a website or get it some other way. And on this one, it's interesting because I really think Apple probably should have just done the deal. No matter how much it costs, they've got a lot of cash on hand, and it would be highly visible promotion for Apple and the Apple TV. But I guess ultimately the executives, you know, didn't agree with my opinion, and really, why should they? All right, I told you a little bit on the San Bernardino case, and it's only because it just keeps getting weirder and weirder. The San Bernardino District Attorney this week, Michael Ramos, made statements in his amicus brief, and these are briefs that go to the court about why or why not, you know, basically they, different experts, different people involved in the case feel that, you know, the case should go forward or the ruling should stand or not. And he said in there that he suspects the iPhone might house a, quote, dormant cyber pathogen. And everybody's trying to figure out exactly what that means. But the implication seems to be that the iPhone used by the suspect in this case may have been used to inject a virus into the computer infrastructure of the government of San Bernardino County. Now, no one beyond the district attorney, including the police or the FBI, have made this claim, so the statements came off a little bit weird. Now, also in this brief, he does make a more rational statement that he believes there could be information on that phone that might implicate or point to other co-conspirators. I think he refers to it as a third co-conspirator. And I think that's really what the FBI is after. They're trying to do their due diligence and see, are there other people in the contacts list that might be persons of interest that they want to pursue or at least investigate. But basically, he's trying to give justifications as to why Apple should be compelled to help the FBI crack the passcode on this subject's phone. And, you know, I get the argument for the persons of interest, but the cyber pathogen thing is just a little far-fetched. And later in an interview, he sort of, cops to the fact that he just sort of made this all up. He was just kind of, you know, thinking of possible scenarios of why they might need to get access. But hey, you know, it's been done before. People have tried to, you know, get things on a corporate network and inject spyware or malware or things like that. So it does happen, but highly unlikely in this case. And then over in France, another weird thing somewhat related to the case, the French Parliament deputies have voted in favor, apparently, of some legislation that would impose fines or jail time for executives who refuse to provide encrypted data to investigators. And apparently this was part of an amendment to a penal reform bill over there, and it would impose penalties of up to 5 years in jail and 350,000 euros, about £270,000, as a fine. And it passed this lower parliament vote, but it still needs to pass the National Assembly and the Senate. And right now it's looking like the French government actually does not favor this amendment. So it may not go any further, but just another thing, you know, with this whole security privacy sort of issue that's cropping up. And this is cropping up in more and more countries. And so now we have France kind of wanting to pass some legislation, or at least some folks there wanting to pass some legislation that would potentially, you know, take away some of our privacy and encryption. As we've discussed on a few MacCasts, it's looking like VR, augmented reality, artificial intelligence is going to be one of the next sort of battlegrounds for tech companies to come out with different technologies. And it's even been rumored that Apple is working on some VR, and they've hired some folks in the industry related to artificial intelligence and virtual reality, augmented reality. And we've talked about all of this, but I think if you ask a lot of people right now, what's the company you think of when you say virtual reality, Oculus Rift is a big one. And Oculus has said recently that they're not going to have a Mac version of the system, at least not right in the beginning. And Oculus CEO Palmer Luckey was asked about when he thinks Oculus Rift will have Mac support, and he certainly did not pull any punches on his answer. He said, quote, "That is up to Apple. If they ever release a good computer, we'll do it." Burn, right? It's a little bit harsh. It sounds a little bit harsh at first, but generally when you step back from it, what he's saying is pretty much true. The Rift actually needs some pretty beefy hardware, especially in the GPU and the graphics processor. And the current lineup of Macs, even the Mac Pro, for those of you who might throw that out there, really doesn't have the chops. The minimum recommended specs for Rift capable machines include a 3.7 gigahertz quad core Intel i5 54 or 4590 processor or better, 8 gigabytes of RAM or more, and an NVIDIA GeForce GTX 970 or AMD Radeon 290 graphics card or better. Now, an iMac or a Mac Pro could cover the CPU and RAM specs, but it's on the GPU where they're falling short. The AMD Fire Pro D700 on the $6,000 Mac Pro still is not good enough. And that's because a VR machine requires that it can hit 90 frames per second in VR games. Otherwise, apparently, motion sickness can really become an issue. You start to feel nauseous, literally, when you're using the system. Now, Apple typically uses mid-level GPUs and CPUs to try and maximize performance versus power consumption, and especially in their notebook models. So this is something Apple has consciously done. It's not a big shock or surprise to anyone. That's why people who are really into PC gaming generally have a PC gaming rig. Now, if Apple would move back to the old days of maybe offering some build-to-order options with the higher-end GPUs, then Rift says, hey, they'd be happy to bring the Oculus Rift system to the Mac. But, you know, barring Apple doing that, we're probably not going to get that system on the Mac. Now, again, going back to what I was saying earlier, that still doesn't mean we're not going to have VR on the Mac, because Apple might not have to rely on Oculus. There's a lot of other companies building systems. They just seem to be the leader at this point. And Apple may end up building its own system itself. And the advantage that Apple would have is the same one that it always has when it's integrating hardware and software. If they do everything end to end, if they build the GPUs, if they build the processors, they can likely do a lot more with less. And we've really been hearing that Apple has been exploring its own custom GPU designs as well as processors. So to date, they've been really focused on the A series processors, but they've got a lot of great chip designers and a lot of great talent in-house. And we have been hearing they've been looking at GPUs and trying to figure out how to better integrate that stuff. So there is that. Now, another and likely better option for folks who want to get Oculus Rift and they want to use it is to simply buy a Windows PC virtual reality rig. They look like they're actually pretty affordable. There's a lot of options that meet the specs out right now, specifically designed for Oculus Rift, that are starting at around $1,049 US and go up to $3,000, $3,200 US in pricing. And that's what I think a lot of Mac gamers do. You'll find they'll have their Mac, that's their workhorse machine, the thing they use day in and day out, and then off to the side they have a custom PC gaming rig for running, you know, software and games off Steam and things like that. And that seems to work out for a lot of people. So you can maybe get a little cheaper Mac, take the extra money and buy your Windows PC gaming rig. You don't have to have that $6,000 Mac Pro. You can get an iMac and then get your Oculus Rift VR gaming rig. And I think that's the way a lot of people are going to go. But, you know, I'm not a huge Mac gamer either, so I don't see this as a big issue. Maybe some of you out there do. And if you have an opinion on this, shoot me an email. Weigh in. An audio comment would be awesome. Record your thoughts. Send them in. MacCast@gmail.com. I think another area of growth for iPhone that we've talked about on the show for Apple is India. And we got some interesting news this week that seems to show Apple is still focused on growing iPhone sales in that country. According to India's telecommunications minister, Apple has applied for government approval to import and resell used iPhones in the country. The government has yet to give approval, and it's not clear which models Apple wants to import, but we do know from other steps and statements that, again, Apple is looking at India as a big growth opportunity for iPhone, and they recently dropped out of the lower end of the market in India. They stopped sales of the iPhone 4S and 5C and then lowered the price on the iPhone 5S. But selling used and refurbished devices could be a way for them to capture more price-conscious iPhone buyers in India now that they don't have those lower-end models available. So they could take that and kind of hit the people who are like, the iPhone 5S is still a little bit too expensive for me. Hey, we've got a refurbished iPhone 5 or 5S here, and you can save $50, $100 US, you know, convert that to rupees. But that could be a way to go. And it's something that Apple does here in the States and in other countries as well. So it makes sense. Of course, Apple's also looking at the iPhone SE to help with those slumping sales. And that strategy may work for them as well, because RBC Capital Markets estimates that the new 4-inch iPhone could sell as many as 10 million units in its first year. And if the rumored price of $400 to $500 US per unit turns out to be true, that's an additional $4 to $5.5 billion in revenue for Apple. And I really think that model is about sort of getting through the slump. I think that's why Apple's announcing it here in the spring, so that they can kind of, you know, get rid of that low slump mid-year as people wait for the new iPhone models to come out in the fall. So they're going to capture all those people who haven't upgraded yet and maybe want a 4-inch model. But looking like good strategy with the iPhone SE and with what they're doing over in India. And then finally in the news for this week, something a little bit scary. We have the Mac's first official ransomware hit the streets this week. This came via a BitTorrent client called Transmission. This app is actually a legitimate app. It's been out for a while. A lot of people like to use it for BitTorrent, but they released a post on their site where they warned that version 2.9 of their app installer had been infected with malware. The malware is called KeyRanger, and somehow it made its way into the official installer that Transmission had put on their website. They're not providing a lot of details about exactly how it happened, but this installer ended up on their website, and it was downloaded by, I think, about 6,500 people before they actually caught it. And what's particularly concerning about it is ransomware. And in case you don't know what ransomware is, it's software that once it gets on your system, it goes through and starts encrypting your files or your whole drive. And then you get a message from the hackers demanding that you pay to actually get the keys so that you can get your data unlocked. Now, specifically with KeyRanger, it looks like there was kind of a 3-day delay before the encryption happened. So it looks like they caught it before most people would have had a problem. But in looking at the software, what would happen is once it's enabled, it connects to a Tor command and control server, a C2 server, and then the ransom was apparently set at $400 US. Now, they quickly patched the software to version 2.91 and then to 2.92, and actually the 2.92 patch will actively remove the malware. So if you did get infected somehow, it will actually remove it. Transmission is an open source project, but it doesn't seem like it made its way into the code. It really seems what happened. And again, Transmission doesn't want to give a lot of the details, I think, because they don't want it to happen again. It appears that the site was somehow compromised and somebody simply swapped out the installer. So they kind of built their own installer with this malware in it and then tried to pass it off through the official website and through the official channels as the legitimate installer. And it was actually signed with a developer certificate, because normally Gatekeeper would have kicked in and prevented you from even being able to run the software. But in this case, it did have an official signing certificate that was revoked. Apple took care of that. So again, this was shut down very, very quickly. But just in case you're out there and you think you may have been infected, again, you would have to have run this Transmission installer that was out there to get infected. But in case you want to check, you can go into your Activity Monitor. So open up Applications Utilities Activity Monitor and check for a running process called Kernel Service. And if you see that, select the process and choose Open Files and Port and see if there is a file listed in there, something like Users Library Kernel Service. If you do see that, you're going to want to terminate that process. You're also going to want to go look for the files .kernel_pid, .kernel_time, .kernel_complete, or kernel service in your existing home folder, library folder. Look in there, and if you find those, remove all of them. You'll note that a couple of them are hidden files, so you might actually have to use the terminal to go in and get at those. But take those out of there. Another indicator that you're infected is the app also seems to include an extra file named general.rtf inside the actual application package. So if you go to the transmission.app, right-click or control-click on it, choose Show Package Contents, and then look in the Contents directory inside the Resources directory or Resources folder. If you see general.rtf, that's a good indication that you have an infected copy. But again, you could just update to the 2.92 version of the software, and it actually will do the cleanup and removal of the malware itself. But this one is, a pretty significant breach and hack. Again, it's just going to impact those of you who are running Transmission out there, but certainly an indication that, hey, we are vulnerable to occasional attacks like this, and it can happen even when you're downloading the software. Because you remember, something that I'll often say is make sure that you're downloading software, you're getting your applications from known good developers. These were known good developers. Unfortunately, it just seems like their system was hacked. So I'm going to give you a couple little bits of advice and tips here in a little bit later in the show on how you could possibly better protect yourself against this specific kind of attack. So stay tuned for that. But with that, that's going to do it for the news for this week. Now, I did say at the top of the show, we have a little bit of follow-up from you on this whole Apple versus FBI thing. If you remember, one of the big things about Apple's counter argument to the court order is that if they can prove that the order would put significant burden on the company, that could be a potential defense. And we talked about some of the ways that Apple plans to do that on the last episode of the MacCast. But a couple of you chimed in. So Leung pointed out that if Apple is forced to create what they're calling this government OS, that another potential burden could be that their engineers would be targeted by bad guys who would try to pay them for the actual code to get them to try and leak the code. That, or possibly it would be people trying to hire them away from Apple so that they could give them the secrets on how to build this backdoor. And while that certainly does happen, if you remember, we talked about in Ireland, Apple employees being offered large sums of money by bad guys to give their corporate login credentials, basically their Apple official iCloud credentials. In this case, there are some other safeguards in place that I think you have to think about. The version of the operating system that Apple would create would need to be signed with Apple's keys in order to be installed on an iOS device. And if Apple did create that version, I would assume that they would actually lock the code away somehow, with very few people actually having access to it. So you could take that version of the OS, I would presume, and put it on some sort of disk or encrypted disk, lock that up itself, lock it away very securely, and it'd be very hard for someone to steal that and then just give it away or sell it away to a bad guy or hacker. And if you had a person that had the knowledge on how to write the code and they were simply hired away by a bad guy to kind of reverse engineer or recreate it, they still wouldn't be able to create a version without the signing key from Apple that would actually run on an iOS device. So Apple might have a hard time making that argument on the burden, but Leung, I totally get where you're coming from on there. That does kind of make sense that that would be a concern of Apple's. And you certainly don't want bad guys approaching your employees and offering them, you know, ludicrous sums of money to kind of hack into the company. And now I guess that kind of already goes on, and Apple is pretty aware of it. Apple Security is aware of it, and I'm sure they kind of try and keep that in check as much as possible. Now, another thing that Sean mentioned was that Apple would have to continually maintain and update government OS or GovOS along with the main version of iOS. So that could also be perceived as a burden if they're having to do it over and over again. And my only counter to that is, again, if they choose to keep a copy of that software around and not rewrite it from scratch every time, then that would kind of be a valid thing. It's like, we have to continually maintain and update this thing once it's created so that it works on each new version. Should you come and make another valid request from us, that's going to be a little more time and effort on our part every single time, or ongoing. Puts an undue burden on the company over time. And that's an interesting argument that they could potentially make as well. But it sounds like they're going to stick to their whole constitutional arguments that, hey, basically, under the Constitution, we don't have to do that. This, and that's probably their strongest argument. So probably the one that they're going to stick to. But I certainly appreciate the feedback, and you guys are great. Those are some great points, and thanks for sending them in. So another thing that happened recently that's interesting is, if you're like me, you have a stack of OS X installers that you've loaded onto USB drives as sort of emergency backup installers. And I just create a new one every time a new version of the OS comes out, and I've collected this cool little set of them. And I'm like thrilled. Hey, like, hey, I've got, you know, OS X Lion, Mountain Lion, Mavericks, Yosemite, El Capitan. I've got five of these things lying around. And it might come as a bit of surprise to you if you try to go back and use them, because Tidbits wrote a piece recently that talked about Apple has let the certificate that those were signed with expire. Not actually expire. That's not a valid. The certificate that those were signed with did expire, basically. And that's the thing that, you know, for security, including in OS X, in the installers, they have to be designed by Apple's developer certificate. And those certificates have an expiration date on them. And so they only work for a period of time, and they have to be renewed. And while Apple does renew those certificates, They would have signed that version of the installer that you have with an older certificate that expired. And that's what's happened in this case. In this case, it's actually the Apple Worldwide Developer Relations Intermediate Certificate that expired. And while Apple would update the application's installers on the App Store, the ones that you downloaded and wrote onto your USB disks or your USB keys, those aren't updated. They don't have the correct signing certificate. So when you go to plug that in, you go to run the installer, it's going to say, hey, wait a minute, that's got an expired certificate. Security violation, I am not going to run that. So it's basically going to fail because now your installer is unsecure under Gatekeeper. So what if you want to have those old installers, guess what you have to do? You have to re-download them from the Mac App Store's purchase section, and you're going to have to rebuild them. I know, I'm not thrilled about this either. Big pain in the butt. But if you need the instructions for that, you can go back to the older MacCast. We've covered that on a couple episodes. You may or may not know how to get the old installers. Basically, you just have to open up the Mac App Store on your Mac, go to the purchase section, and you should be able to see every version that you've ever downloaded. Now, one thing to note is you can only see the installers in the purchase section that are compatible for the Mac that you're running the Mac App Store on. So if you have a newer Mac and you're trying to get an older installer, you may or may not actually see that, or vice versa. If you're on an older Mac and you're trying to get, you know, OS X El Capitan, and it's not a Mac that runs that, you're not going to see it. So there is kind of a hack around the certificate check. So if you really wanted to take that old installer that you have and install it on a Mac, you could potentially roll the Mac's clock back to before February 14th, 2016. That's the date the old certificate expired, and it may run. So you could give that a shot. But just wanted to make you aware of that in case you have any of those old installers lying around. Now, let's talk about that ransomware a little bit more, because there were a couple pieces from Mac Kung Fu and Apple Insider, and I'll link to both of them in the show notes at maccast.com, that had some great tips on keeping you safe from the next potential ransomware Trojan. And Mac Kung Fu pointed out an application that I had not heard about before, something called BlockBlock app. And this is basically something you can run on your Mac. It runs as a background app. And the cool thing that it does is it keeps an eye on the places in your system where persistent background applications typically run from. So there's a lot of programs that run software in the background. For example, I use CrashPlan for my backup. It has a process that does that, or I have scheduled processes for certain apps. There's all kinds of background stuff that's legit that runs on your Mac, and that gets installed in certain places on the system. So this is going to watch for that. And then anything that installs a piece of persistent software, it's going to pop up an alert, a display, and give you some information, say, hey, this is the thing that I just saw started running. This is what I think it's doing, and it's going to give you options to block or allow the software to run. So you can say, oh yeah, I know that's for my backup program or for that, for some other piece of software that I have. That's fine. But if a piece of ransomware suddenly got on your system installed, it's going to pop up now and show you that. And you can control the little BlockBlock application from the menu bar. So you can disable it if you know you're going to be running an installer. You can sort of silence it, do all that stuff. But a nice little thing that's going to kind of watch for this background stuff. Now, it is in beta. I went to the website. It is in beta. So just be aware of that. They have a nice little message on there. Hey, this is beta software. But it seems like a really good tool and something, especially now that we know this ransomware Trojan stuff exists targeting the Mac, might be something you might consider installing. Another thing that you can help use to help protect yourself is to use an app like Little Snitch. Little Snitch is an application that will watch for and alert you, kind of in the same way as the BlockBlock, to outgoing connections, network connections that might be happening. So a lot of malware, spyware, ransomware, it needs to call back to those command and control servers. So with Little Snitch installed, it's going to recognize that, and it's going to say, hey, I just saw this app, and it's trying to go out and here's the server that it's going to and where it's going, and this looks a little bit suspicious. Do you want to allow it, block it? What do you want to do? And so Little Snitch is another cool little handy tool. I know a lot of people run it. I typically don't run it because I felt it's a little too verbose, but you can tweak all those things too. And our friend George Starcher, who is, you know, big on security, as you know, he definitely runs Little Snitch. And so if you're concerned about that sort of thing, it's a great app to look into, and it would help protect you in the case of, again, these ransomware kind of Trojans getting installed. Another good little bit of advice, always, and you're always going to hear this from me, have offsite backups, since the ransomware will typically try to encrypt all of your local files. If you get hit by this and you notice it, you can turn it off really quickly before your offsite backup runs. Then at least if it gets in there, encrypts all your local data, you can go to your offsite backups and grab those. The problem with a local backup, something like SuperDuper or a clone or Carbon Copy clone, is that the ransomware typically goes through any connected drive, and it's going to try and find files, certain things, and encrypt them. So you want to have some sort of offsite backup. I guess another thing that you could do is you could manually backup to a USB drive that wasn't always connected. So you do your backup, you disconnect it, and that way, if you did get infected with the ransomware, it's not even going to be able to go out and see those files to encrypt them. So that would be another way to kind of better protect yourself. And then Apple Insider's piece takes a little bit more proactive approach, a little bit nerdier approach too. And this may or may not be something that you're aware of, but it describes how to use something called checksums that are on the installer to verify that it actually is a legitimate installer, even if you know you're getting it from the legitimate website. Because remember, this was a case where their installer was compromised. It was put on their website. You were downloading something directly from the developer, yet it was still infected. So this is how you can check against that. And if you look on their website next to their installer, you'll see something that says checksum or hash. And you see this on a lot of websites that offer up installers for direct download. And what these are, and they look like a long series of alphanumeric characters, but what they are basically software fingerprints. And the fingerprint is taken from the software installer that the developer originally uploads. So they say, okay, here's the fingerprint of the thing that I put on my server. Now you can take that fingerprint and you can run the same process on the installer that you download, get its fingerprint, and compare that to my original fingerprint. And if the two fingerprints match, then you know that's a legit copy. If something was altered or tweaked, the fingerprints aren't going to match, and that should raise your suspicion, going, what happened here? So there are typically kind of three kinds of hashes or checksums that you'll see: SHA-1, SHA-256, or MD5. And it doesn't really matter which one is being used, other than you need to know which one is being used so that when you run your own check, you can use the appropriate kind. But the kind will be listed with that hash number generally next to the installer on the developer's website. So in the case, for example, of Transmission, they were using SHA-256. And you essentially use the terminal application to input an appropriate command. You point it at the installer file that you downloaded, and you get it to return this hash, this fingerprint, and then, like I said before, you compare that result to the result that was posted on the developer's website. And if they match, you know you're good to go. The installer is legit. If not, you can assume the installer was changed or might have been tampered with, and maybe you don't want to run it. At the very least, you're going to want to check with the developer, because it's possible the developer put up a new update and somehow forgot to update the hash or the fingerprint that they display on the website. But at least you know now, hey, I should be a little wary of this installer. Maybe I need to contact them to check. And what's cool is this technique would work too, even if you download the installer from another website, as long as it was, you know, said to be the installer that the developer built and put out for distribution. So often other sites will distribute software for a main developer. You could use that same checksum technique to verify its fingerprint and make sure that you were okay. So there you have it, a couple of cool little tips on protecting yourself from ransomware and malware. Now, I'm not sure what it's going to take for Apple to get HomeKit right, but I can tell you right now, it is not right. We've talked about HomeKit a few times on the podcast, and I think it's no secret that, one, I love it, but at the same time, I also often hate it. And Matt wrote in to kind of express some of the same frustrations that I think a lot of us feel when we're dealing with HomeKit. Now, he has, it sounds like, a Hue bridge, a Philips Hue bridge, some Hue lights, an Echo Bee, which is a thermostat, so lights and thermostat and a bridge to kind of control it all. And he was saying, you know, I'll try to give the Siri command for turn the lights off, and the lights will go off, but then Siri times out. I get these weird errors, or Siri sometimes can't communicate at all, or very often can't communicate at all with my thermostat. So I try to find out, hey, what's the thermostat stat set at? And it just simply says, I can't find your thermostat. You don't have a thermostat. I don't see it on the network. And I think we've all experienced these things when we've been using HomeKit. And he did mention that he also uses the Home app, which is a great third-party HomeKit app that can see all of your HomeKit devices. I think we've talked about it on the show in the past. But when he launches that, it shows that all of his accessories, all of his HomeKit devices on his network are showing errors next to them. And it's like, what is going on? And he got so frustrated, Matt told me he even tried a full reset. He basically logged out of iCloud and HomeKit, got rid of everything, started all over, re-registered all of his devices, which if you've messed with HomeKit, you know that's not a minimal process. Yeah, it's easier than maybe some other systems, but it's still not fun to go through. Did all that, still no fix. Interestingly, though, he discovered one thing that did seem to fix his problems, and that was logging out of iCloud. So registering all the HomeKit devices but not being logged into iCloud, he said, suddenly everything started working. I was having no issues. And then the minute that I logged back into my iCloud account, I started having problems all over again. So the question became, okay, is there some sort of thing with the iCloud integration that's causing a problem? And any of us who have dealt with Apple and iCloud for any amount of time know that Apple's never been very good at this cloud stuff. They seem to struggle with it. So I understand, Matt, where you're coming from on this theory. And some people might not realize that HomeKit even uses iCloud. It doesn't have to use iCloud. As far as I know, it's only really used and only should be used when you're trying to access your iCloud stuff from outside your home network. So when you're on your home network, I would think that it would stay internal to that home network, even if you have iCloud turned on. Now, that may not be the case just based on Matt's findings, but I don't have any evidence of that. I don't know specifically how it works. And the other thing is, in order to use iCloud with HomeKit, I believe you have to have a third generation Apple TV or better on your home network, because it kind of comes through that connection as the bridge into your internal network. And so you can actually see the HomeKit iCloud settings if you go into settings on your iOS device and then choose HomeKit. And then from in there, you can select your home, and you'll notice that there's an allow remote access option, a little toggle switch, and you can toggle that on or off. You can also, from this interface, invite other people with iCloud accounts to be part of or have access to your HomeKit network. So this is handy if you've got multiple people in your family. Like, my wife is on my list, so I've set up all the iCloud, or the HomeKit stuff rather, and then invited her to be part of that HomeKit sharing, basically. And so the main two reasons, I guess, for iCloud integration are those, remote access and being able to have other people as part of the HomeKit control system. But Matt, what you might try, I would imagine, is since your issues seem to be related maybe to iCloud, and you obviously don't want to be logged out of iCloud all the time, your iCloud accounts, because you need that for other stuff, is maybe play around and see if turning off the allow remote access option in the HomeKit settings actually fixes the issue. And if it does, then that would be a good indication that, yeah, maybe something is wrong with the iCloud indication. To me, it would also seem to indicate that even when you're on your home local network, it's still trying to go out through the internet and do some stuff, because turning that off would then say, okay, you can't get outside the home network, just stay in this local network. And maybe that brings us closer to finding a resolution. So I don't know if that would work or not, but I can tell you for sure that you are not alone in your frustrations with HomeKit. The system can often be very finicky. I'll try to issue the command for my lights, which happen to be Insteon's, not Philips Hue. And Siri will say, oh, I've done it. I've turned off your lights. You know, I give her the command, turn off the lights. Yep, lights are off. And no, they're not. They're completely on. Sometimes I'll give a command and it'll take a very long time for it to go through. Now, for me, when that happens, I have found that sometimes simply restarting my iPhone, so holding the sleep wake button and the home button and completely doing a hard reboot of it, will sometimes fix my issues. And then when it comes back up, I can do all of my HomeKit stuff. So that, to me, when I do that, I think, well, maybe it's something local related to the HomeKit software running on my iOS device. But that's all part of the frustration, right? Is we don't know what is causing the issues. Now, for me, things did seem to get better, and this could be purely coincidental, I don't know. But when I added my custom Raspberry Pi built Homebridge hub, and we talked about Homebridge on a previous podcast, but it's basically an open source project that lets you build your own hub and you can do your own integrations. They have plugins and it'll even let you integrate with devices that are not official HomeKit devices. So I, for example, can now access my Nest thermostat. And coincidentally, that has always worked. From the time I set up the Homebridge hub and integrated that, I've had zero issues with that. Not the same can be said about my Insteon Pro system, which is official HomeKit compatible, you know, stuff right from the factory. That doesn't always seem to work. Although Insteon did recently put out another firmware update. So they've issued two or three firmware updates for the hub, and it does seem to get better every single time. So I don't know if you checked to see if your Philips Hue system had a firmware update or software update, but staying on top of software updates, I think, in HomeKit is another thing that's going to help smooth things out. But I know I've talked to Kelly Gaumont about this, and she is totally frustrated. She has a lot of home automation stuff, and getting it all to talk together and work reliably, especially with Siri, has not been a great experience. So Apple has a way to go before this is truly like plug and play easy. And then I have one last item for you in today's episode. This comes from Derek. He mentions an issue that also, like the HomeKit stuff, has frustrated me in the past as well. And that is the autocorrect feature on your iOS devices and your Macs sometimes being too smart, because they have this system where they learn words that you frequently type. So as you go along, it learns more and more about how you type and what you type, and words that aren't in the standard dictionary or the built-in dictionary, it starts to add those in. It sees things like, oh, I type Christensen a lot because that's my last name. So let's add that in there, or it might pull stuff in from context. But it builds this own autocorrect dictionary that's completely customized to you. And in Derek's case, he has a dog named Elwood. Great name, by the way, Derek. That's an awesome name for a dog. And now the iPhone knows Elwood's name. And so you may see where this is leading, because the current operating system is called El Capitan, right? So when he starts to type EL and then hits that space, guess what? It autocorrects to Elwood. And nothing can be more frustrating than wanting to type El Capitan and it comes out Elwood Captain. Or Capitan, rather. Worse, the iCloud dictionary itself, if you use iCloud, the dictionary is synced. So every Mac and every device will start making that same autocorrect. And yeah, it becomes completely frustrating. So the question from Derek was, what can I do about this? Is there a way to get, you know, that changed to say, I don't want Elwood in my custom dictionary? And unfortunately, there doesn't seem to be a way to actually get at individual words or items in that dictionary, at least that I could find. Maybe somebody in the community will know. But I think your best bet, Derek, is to maybe try to retrain the dictionary. And that's not obvious how you do that. So basically, the way you retrain it is when you start typing EL and it starts to make that wrong suggestion, right? It's going to pop up Elwood. Before you hit the space, tap on that little X next to the word Elwood that popped up. And that's going to tell it, no, that's not right. That's not the word I was going for. I really wanted L. And you'll probably have to do it a few times. I don't know how many, probably quite a bit. But eventually, it should unlearn the wrong correction. It should figure it out, and you kind of just retrain it that way. If you don't want to wait for that, if you want to go a little bit more extreme, you actually can completely reset the dictionary. So you can get rid of all of the training that it's done. So it's kind of like an all or nothing sort of thing. The way you would do that is you go into settings under general into reset and then look for the reset keyboard dictionary option. Now, when you select that, you're going to get a warning. Hey, we're going to delete all this stuff and you're going to need to enter your passcode to continue. But if you really want to do it, you can completely wipe it out and start over. And then you're going to have to retrain it with all your custom words. And so that might be something you want to do or might not, depending upon how many years you've been building up that dictionary, right? Because it gets backed up and put onto new devices. And, you know, some of those corrections are actually handy and not frustrating. But you have that option. As a final option, or really a workaround that I could think of, would be that you could go in and set your own keyboard shortcuts for words like El Capitan. So, you know, forget, just let it do the Elwood thing, but you could set up a separate shortcut for El Capitan. Maybe you use the shortcut LCAP, you know, ELCAP. So you would go into settings, general keyboards, go into the shortcuts section, add a new shortcut, give it a short name of LCAP, and then put in the correct text that you want typed, El Capitan, save that, and then every time you want to spell out or type out El Capitan, just type LCAP space, and boom, it should expand into that. Now, some people like to use a little special character before the shortcut text, something like a comma, so maybe comma L would be another way you could do that shortcut, something that you're not likely to type. And that's just simply to avoid conflicts between your shortcut and actual words. So try to make them unique. You can add a special character or something before them. I've known people that'll use like a square bracket or, you know, any other thing that you commonly wouldn't type together would be a good way to handle that. But you have that option. You could also try the same trick with a third-party app like Text Expander, and then use their third-party keyboard to kind of handle the expansion of those shortcuts. And so that would be a little bit of a workaround. But I think probably your best bet is to start off trying to retrain the dictionary by just using the little X when it makes the wrong suggestion. So give that a shot. I hope that helps you out. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on all their great software at smilesoftware.com/MacCast. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth at gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can visit them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me emails and audio comments. The address is maccast@gmail.com. If you prefer to just leave a voicemail, you can call in on our listener hotline. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is the MacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. Or you can check out the MacCast Google Plus community, and that is google.com/plusMacCast, and that's the plus symbol. But with that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.